The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition this week. This Q&A show is actually going to be tied into the current EDU series we're doing, because on today's show we're going to tackle some of the questions that we've gotten as we walk people through our philosophy and approach to retirement planning on the current EDU series that's playing. So Jim's gotten quite a few questions, so we felt we can just clean those up in a Q&A show here, at least, you know, probably not all of them, but good slice of them. And so that'll be the theme for today. We'll be working with the questions that have come in about our approach to retirement planning, which we're, I don't know if we'd call it in the middle of, but we're in the midst of doing a multi-part series, again, kind of with the latest version of our retirement planning process, which is always kind of evolving to a certain degree. We did a similar series a few years ago, maybe 4 years ago at this point, and so we felt it was time to do a nice update to that, and that's where we're going on the EDU show, if you haven't been keeping up on that side of things. So I'll bring Jim in at this point and let him share with us the questions that he's gotten related to our EDU series here. So welcome, Jim.
Thank you, Chris, and welcome everybody to another episode of the Retirement and IRA Show. As Chris said, this is the Q&A version of the show, but it's going to be kind of a carryover from the EDU series that we're doing. We're going to be exciting today. We're going to add some excitement to the podcast. No, Chris is not going to record this podcast topless like he did to add a little spice and excitement a few weeks ago. We're going to not follow a typical path of doing Social Security questions to begin with, and then the new question of the week, and maybe an IRMA question, and then some other questions. We're going to kind of dive right into some feedback, some dialogue we have been receiving. Some of it is dialogue, some of it is questions relating to the series of our approach. Our approach at the firm, we name our approach the Secure Retirement Income Process. But again, our approach and where we're really talking right now on the series is minimum dignity floor and secure income. We haven't gone into fund number deeply yet. We haven't gone into investment positioning and see-through portfolio and those concepts. So the PSAs and the questions kind of revolve around where we are on the EDU show. So I'm going to lead, Chris, with some PSAs. We received about 5 emails, and many of them are very, very close in what they're talking about. And it has to do with cognitive decline and our brain's loss of its capability of following financial concepts and studies that have shown it begins at around age 53. And it doesn't mean, and the studies have shown, it doesn't mean at 53 in a day, you're dumb as a brick when it comes to finances. It's just that the parts of our brain that understand financial concepts, studies, I guess, have shown, I'm certainly not a neurologist, studies have shown that part of our brain begins to decline, begins to age after age 53 for most people. I believe, and I'm not 100% certain, it must be a bell curve. There are going to be those on the extreme ends of the bell curve. Some really never, some people, let's face it, folks, never really develop much financial knowledge ever. And then there's going to be some people on the other end of the bell curve who will be sharp as a tack right up to the day they pass away. But for most of us, we will begin to decline in our knowledge. So I received a couple of emails in reference to that. So I want to address them because this is a big part of what I personally believe and what Chris obviously personally believes, or he wouldn't be working with us as a team doing what we do. The first set of emails, and I believe, Chris, they're referencing the same podcast, even though the age is a little different of the person they're talking about. I think they're talking about the same podcast because they actually came in within a week of each other. So apparently the New York Times did a podcast, and I have not listened to it. One of the emails, the listener did give a link to the podcast. I have not listened to it. I will see if Jacob can put this podcast link into our show notes. But in short, both these people wanted me to mention to everyone the cognitive decline and the risks that that poses. So this first person wrote, and he said, "I love your podcast and look forward to it twice a week. Thank you for all you and Chris and the team do. This is not a question, but I want to share with you and your listeners the below link. It's from the New York Times, and it describes a scam made possible by something you and Chris have repeatedly mentioned. In this case, there was a retired police officer who was just in his early 70s, and the other email mentioned he was 71, so that's why I think they're talking about the same podcast. And he was ripped off by a timeshare scam that turned into something far greater. Towards the end of the podcast, the victim actually explains that he now knows he was duped, while thinking that he should have been able to have spotted this as a scam a mile away, but he didn't. This podcast is an example of what you and Chris have discussed many, many times, how our decision-making declines while our confidence remains high. I wouldn't necessarily say our decision-making declines. Our ability to understand and, I don't want to say discuss, but follow and participate in financial topics declines. Our confidence remains high. These are two separate studies. And apparently, Chris, and I did not listen, listeners, to the podcast, and I will put the link in the show notes. I asked Jacob to do it for you. He said, the combination of poor decision-making and strong confidence led to a disaster in the making. Thank you again for all you are doing for your clients. And he gave his real name, but he called himself George, and he said he's from Connecticut. There is another listener who a week earlier wanted me to share with all of you the same thing. And he writes, I have heard you and Chris many times warn your listeners about cognitive decline that starts at around age 53. Most recently, you discussed it at some length on your April 13th episode. I don't remember that, Chris. That's almost a month ago, but I guess we talked about it on April 13th. I was recently listening to a podcast that has a real-life example of this happening to a 71-year-old former law enforcement officer who was scammed, you ready, folks, out of $900,000. I thought you and your listeners will find it interesting. He doesn't give a link, but he does say it is a New York Times podcast that came out on April 12th, and the name is How One Family Lost $900,000 in a Timeshare Scam. So you can probably Google it and find it, or look in the show notes, and hopefully Jacob will put those in there. Why am I leading with this? We got another email, which was more of a PSA as well, and I have to thank this man. He sent the email to you as well, Chris, and he really went in and started digging through this age 53 cognitive decline. And he attached, do you know, Chris, is there a way, can we, like, he sent us reprints from the Wall Street Journal and a few other websites. I believe he sent us the actual Harvard study that I talk about all the time. Can we somehow have those in the show notes that people can access?
We'll have to check and see if the articles are freely available and we can link to those. And
okay.
Then same thing with the Harvard study itself. We'll just see where those reside, and if we can easily link to them in the show notes, I'll talk to Jacob about a way to do that if we can.
Okay. But this gentleman sent a tremendous amount of information, and I want to thank him. It was amazing. He did also want to share, because we got another email from a gentleman who wanted us to give credit to Dr. Louis Mandel, who has written extensively on cognitive decline after age 53, and not just reference a quote-unquote Harvard study. But this other listener who did send the Harvard study and confirm the Harvard study wanted to also set the record straight that there is a Harvard study. And I know there's a Harvard study because I read it years ago. The point from both these listeners, the one with Dr. Mandel and this other gentleman who went out and found all these different articles from the Wall Street Journal and the Harvard study itself and all this other information, you will go through this. I know we all like to think it's going to be the quote-unquote other guy, and we talk about this constantly on the podcast. But right now we're knee-deep in trying to teach you on the EDU show how to calculate and the theory behind and the reasoning we do minimum dignity floor and why we cover it with lifetime guaranteed secure income. And it's not just because we fear you're going to outlive your money. It's nice to know, the younger you know, whether that's 55, 60, 65, 70, who knows, whatever age you are now as you're crunching these numbers, I'm sure it's going to make you feel good knowing your income is a bottomless cup of coffee and it's going to just keep coming and your projections show it should hopefully cover the minimum dignity floor. That's nice from an emotional standpoint. I get that. But most of you, outliving your money is probably not one of your main concerns. It's probably more, if you like our style and approach, finding your fun number. Out of my X number of dollars, whether it's a million or 2 million or 3 million or more, how much of that can I spend on fun? Because I love the concept of go-go, slow-go, no-go, as in reference to fun spending there, folks. And I want to spend the majority of my fun money while I can. So how much of my $2, $3, $4 million can I spend on fun? That's what many of you are probably doing. And I know you VGs. I know you like the back of my hand. Is it the back of my hand or the front of my hand? What do I know them as?
The back.
The palm of my hand.
No, the back.
No, I think it's the palm of your hand. I think you know them like the palm of your hand.
I don't think so.
Huh. All right, whatever. I know you really well. I know you better than you know yourself. I don't know if it's the front of my hand or the back of my hand, but I know you. And you hate annuities. You despise them. You don't need secure income. You're going to cover this with safe withdrawals or just managing your money. You want to find out what the fun number is so you can spend on fun, but you're going to cover your expenses by managing your assets. All's what I want you to understand. One of the reasons, there's two main reasons we like to use secure income, Social Security pension and income annuities, to cover minimum dignity floor. First, it continues forever, so if you did outlive your money, it's wonderful to know it's there. But the second reason, folks, it's simple. It's easy. It's going to be easy for you to understand. Maybe so easy for you to understand, it's boring. But that's good, because at some point, you might be, and I haven't listened to the podcast, you might be that New York retired police officer who was scammed out of $900,000. And apparently in the podcast admits later, he should have seen this as a scam and he can't believe he didn't. I'm not saying you're going to be scammed out of $900,000, but as you age and cognitive slowdown, even if it's not a decline, sets in, at least with respect to your finances, but you're also battling confidence that's not declining and you don't even realize you're not doing things right anymore, or someone is trying to step in, maybe a spouse who never really got into this to begin with because you died, or maybe an agent under a POA like a child is trying to step in and help you. And if you leave them a very complex algorithm-driven Excel spreadsheet projected financial mess that made sense to you in your 40s, 50s, and maybe even 60s, it may not make as much sense in your 70s, 80s, and 90s to you, to your spouse, to your agent. But steady lifetime income, taking care of your food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care will make sense to them and to you just coming in. I know this wasn't a question, Chris, but anything you want to add? I thought I like the emails. I like the PSAs that they're sharing with us. And obviously, it's resonating with people. They're getting what we have been saying for years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that this cognitive decline thing, I am worried for people about falling victim. Probably that's my greatest fear with the cognitive decline. Certainly, it's going to open the door to mistakes and things, but a lot of times a mistake that you make can be undone. A lot of these scams that you fall for can't be undone, and that's and can cause real permanent damage. And they just seem to be becoming more and more common out there as, you know, the predators out there are realizing that they can victimize folks that are in this situation where they have this cognitive decline. So, yes, I think the simplicity so you don't make silly mistakes is a benefit. I'm not trying to minimize it by any means. It's just that, you know, what keeps me troubled is doing what you possibly can to prevent being victimized, because it's just seemingly, I know it's still a small part of the overall population, but I think anymore, everybody pretty much knows someone who's fallen victim. Now, not to the 900,000 degree, you know, to the size of this particular example, but I think if you don't know someone who's been victimized, you know someone who's been targeted, and maybe they didn't fall for it, but it's out there and prevalent. And just don't put your older self in a position to have to worry about things in such a way that it increases the likelihood of this. You're probably not going to absolutely prevent being targeted or attempts being made, but overall simplicity in your life will help you avoid this. And then also have, I think this is a good argument for having someone overseeing some of your situations. So that what I hear time and time again in these stories is they eventually at the end might realize, maybe when it's too late, that they could have seen the signs. If someone had been in contact with them and they'd been open with them, and they had kind of seen all the steps that were happening, the grooming that was happening over some period of time, they could have stopped it or headed off or asked the right questions or what have you. So having loved ones or others that are kind of brought in, I know a lot of people are not open with their finances, with their family, and friends, trusted friends, contacts, etc. But whether you've got a professional helping you with some oversight, which could be some type of financial advisor that is just extra eyes on the situation that might be able to pick up on strange things that are happening, or a trusted individual, family or friend that can be part of your financial lives, I think would lessen the likelihood of something like this happening as well. So that's all I wanted to add.
Excellent. All right. Hopefully that gave you all some food for thought as you project your own retirement. You're going to do what works for you, but do understand that our belief in covering MDF with secure income is not just the risk of outliving your assets, which is a very real risk for many, many, many people in this country. Sadly, probably far too many people in this country. But for the majority of our listeners, it's probably not the biggest risk. We say it's many of our listeners, yes, they could run into the same issue. But I think more than half, it's not an issue of outliving your money. We don't want you to necessarily say, well, I've got so much, I don't need to worry about secure income. I think you should, because of the reasons we list with the cognitive decline. Okay, next thing that seems to add some confusion to our recent discussion, and no surprise, Chris, taxes. Taxes seem to constantly cause confusion, especially because we say taxes are not part of your minimum dignity floor. That confuses the hell out of people. Because most people are like the software programs in that story that I shared with you on last week's EDU show, who felt taxes were so important, they made it automatic in what their software called required expenses. And when Chris and I indicated there's only 5 categories of required expenses that we wanted a report for, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, we kept getting a report with a number much, much bigger than we expected, because the software was looking at the taxes, but not just the taxes that were owed on the sources of secure income the particular client may have had. So if there was Social Security, pension, and or income annuity, one of them, two of them, or all three of them, it wasn't just throwing those taxes into the quote-unquote required pool. It was looking at taxes owed on dividends, interest, part-time income, RMDs from 401ks and IRAs and other types of retirement accounts. It was throwing all those taxes. And that's where Chris and I disagree. And this listener sent one email, couldn't quite get it, then another email saying she got it. So I thought this would be a good email to use for a tax discussion, and I'll let Chris handle most of the discussion on taxes and why we do it again the way we do it. We're not saying we don't prioritize taxes. We're not advocating you don't pay your taxes. We advocate we advocate you try to reduce your taxes as much as possible, as legally as possible. But we don't think you should annuitize most of the taxes you're going to owe. And when I say annuitize, that's just a verb that we use to reference turning a pool of money into a lifetime stream of income to cover a shortage in your minimum dignity floor. Because most of you will have Social Security, a few of you will have pension in addition to Social Security. But at some point in time, maybe not right now, we always say your job is to make sure you put enough money aside so the older you can go to that reserve and make a decision on if they want to buy an annuity or not to cover the shortage in their minimum dignity floor as it begins to grow throughout your retirement. Okay, so here's her first email, and then I'll read her second email where she figured it out. So she wrote first, "Dear Jim and Chris, I love your show and your retirement philosophy, but I just listened to your latest podcast, and I'm struggling with one concept, your lack of inclusion of taxes in the minimum dignity floor. If I have $100,000 of Social Security, and it is my only source of guaranteed income, and let's just say it currently covers my entire minimum dignity floor need of $85,000, I still have to pay taxes forever on that $100,000. Can you please explain why those taxes should not be added to my food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses? I can't wrap my head around why taxes are not included in the minimum dignity floor." Then she wrote back, "So, I decided to listen to your podcast again, and it appears that taxes on guaranteed income are added to core minimum dignity floor expenses, just not taxes on other sources of income above and beyond taxes associated with secure income. Now I get it! ! Yippee! ! She goes on to say, "I'm a VG, and I need a VG, folks, if you don't know, is a Vanguard engineer. I know all of you don't have your money at Vanguard, and all of you are not engineers. I call you VGs as a play on BGs, you know, the group we grew up with in the 70s. VGs is just referencing the V for Vanguard, your do-it-yourself investor. And the VG for engineer is, even though you're not an engineer, you do have that engineer mindset where you want to crunch your own numbers and write your own Excel spreadsheets, hence VGs. As a VG, I need a strategy that I can fully believe in. One that addresses all," and she puts it in capital, "all essential expenses that you will never outlive, even if you run out of money. So I urge you to consider the taxes on secure income be included in your minimum dignity floor calculation. You should start saying food, utilities, transportation, housing, healthcare, and guaranteed income taxes. Thank you for sharing a retirement strategy that does make sense, one that maximizes lifetime financial security while at the same time maximizes fun." ! On that one. "And for encouraging this dialogue with your listeners." Thank you. And I'm going to let Chris opine.
Yeah, I think part of this discussion becomes semantics, because where you handle the taxes, you know, as long as you're handling them appropriately, maybe isn't that critical. The way, and I've gone round and round with people kind of explaining, trying to explain our thought process on this and why we think there should be a distinction between income taxes by source and that sort of thing. But I think that that will clarify it in people's minds, at least that will explain our thought process, is income taxes are not a result of having minimum dignity floor expenses. They're not a result of you living and needing to be alive. Minimum dignity floor expenses are needed to protect your basic standard of living in the form of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare. You don't need to pay income taxes in order to maintain that standard of living. Income taxes are generated and related to income recognition. So the income taxes are really attached to that side of the equation, and it is part of the broader story because, of course, we're trying to identify your minimum dignity floor expenses in our approach so that we can determine how much lifetime secure income you might need to protect those expenses so that they are covered throughout your life, whether you have assets or not. So if you just keep in mind, the income tax part that you have to deal with is really part of the income question. Where are you getting the money to pay your expenses? And that money, if as you acquire it, distribute it, receive it, whatever you want to call it, has tax implications, you need to essentially net that out. You've got to address the fact that there's taxes on your, say, IRA distribution or your annuity that you might have that is in a form that would be taxable, or your pension that is likely taxable, and it's the net that's left over. Now, you can accommodate those taxes in an equation on either side. You can make them an expense, which subtracts them out, or you can just use a net after-tax income estimate. But one way or another, you're going to net those out of there. But they aren't really the same as our other five categories of minimum dignity floor expenses. They're like this one-off that is truly generated by the income recognition, or, you know, more broadly, cap gains, etc., can have their own taxes, which aren't technically income taxes, but taxes that you owe. So if you keep that in mind, then when you go to devise a plan to cover your minimum dignity floor, you then realize only the income that's going to cover the minimum dignity floor is all we're going to focus on to determine if we have enough of it in secure style. And therefore, only the income taxes related to that income are in question when we're talking about covering the minimum dignity floor. Other distributions you make or income you receive for fun, those taxes don't need to be brought into the minimum dignity floor conversation because those are attached to the income being used to cover fun expenses. That's kind of a separate part of our conversation, which we're going to get into in the upcoming shows on the EDU side. We haven't gotten to the fun part yet. So maybe if I describe it like that, it'll clarify things for people. It isn't that we're dismissing the, you know, obligation to pay income taxes when you owe them. I think people are hanging their hat on that. If I owe income taxes, they're required to be paid. True. I agree. But if you're not generating income taxes to cover fun expenses, those taxes go away, right? Either because you've run out of assets or you're not taking the money out to cover those fun expenses. It's variable. It just depends on what you're doing. So we'd like to clean it up. And if you don't do it this way, you'll fall victim to what Jim and I fell victim to early on in this approach, where we were trying to recommend a certain amount of secure income people have to cover their minimum dignity floor expenses. And that what we fell for was we overestimated how much secure income would be needed if we included all the taxes of the whole situation, including the taxes on income that was going to pay for fun expenses. We wrap that all up into this concept of minimum dignity floor. Then we're out recommending, I mean, certainly if I was a professional annuity salesman, I would be all for that approach because that's going to bloom your minimum dignity floor expenses higher, which would then justify me, quote, selling you a larger income annuity. We're not in the business of trying to sell you an annuity in this approach. We're simply trying to devise a simple to follow process and approach to funding the core expenses that people are going to have for the rest of their lives. Minimum dignity floor is what we call it. So we only go to the conversation of an income annuity when there's not enough secure income naturally from other sources you might have, Social Security, pensions if you have them, that we feel that you should embellish those other sources a bit to give you true protection for the minimum dignity floor. We don't want to oversell it and cover a bunch of unnecessary taxes in that. Those taxes will be satisfied by the assets that are generating those taxes. So it's kind of a side story for those taxes. So hopefully that helps a little bit. It sounds like this particular listener wrapped their minds around it a little bit, although at the end, she suggested we create this sixth formal category in the minimum dignity floor. Hopefully what I just said kind of justifies why we don't really do it that way. Taxes we still see as it's this unique animal that we have to address, but it's not still the same as those other five categories. So throwing it in there, I'm not sure.
But Chris, it's also safe to say we do address taxes in a calculation where we tell a person what they're going to need for minimum dignity floor. We do try to estimate what the taxes are going to be net of the income and make sure the net amount is enough to cover their expenses. Mm-hmm. So maybe she thinks we're not doing that. We do that, and you should do that. We just don't believe in annuitizing taxes associated with other sources of income.
Right.
But we do look at the net tax number. If somebody needs, and she said $85,000 to cover her minimum dignity floor, we're not just going to generate $85,000 in an annuity because we know net of taxes they won't have enough.
Right.
So we'll net taxes into the annuity quote. So we do address it, and maybe they think we don't do that. We do that. Mm-hmm. We just don't look at the taxes associated with RMDs from the IRA or the 401k or if they have part-time income or if they're a consultant or whatever. We don't associate or try to annuitize those taxes.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Next question came in. He began with his condolences on the passing of my dad. Thank you very much. And to everyone who has sent me emails on that, I do thank you. This whole entire series, which would, I guess, include these Q&A series as well, dedicated to our process, is dedicated to my dad. Okay, he begins. I discovered your podcast just in the last year, and your format resonates with me. I don't know if it's the format of the podcast or the format of our approach to retirement planning, but something resonates with him. I'm 2 years away from my own planned retirement at age 65. While we, and by we he means him and his wife, folks, while we are well-funded for retirement, I find your approach of using secure income to cover my minimum dignity floor expenses appealing for many of the reasons you mention on your podcast. In particular, I have been an ardent accumulator and anticipate a challenging transition trying to spend my money. We've heard that before, have we not, Chris?
Very regularly.
So it's, I think what he might be saying, folks, I'm definitely reading between the lines here, but one of the ways, another reason, so we can put why Chris and I like secure income to cover minimum dignity floor. We all know, in case you run out of money, cognitive decline, and emotional risk. I totally forgot to mention that one today.
And leaving something simple for a spouse that may not be interested in this, because a lot of podcast listeners out there, it's not the two of you listening to us, it's one of you. One of the spouses is listening and they're really into this. The other one, not so much, which is okay. They've got other redeeming qualities and other interests, and that's fabulous. But if you, the one who's really interested in this, goes first, do you not want to leave something behind that's straightforward and less complicated for your spouse who may not be as into this as you are? I think the answer should be yes. That's another
Absolutely.
Reason we didn't mention.
Yep. But for the emotional risk, it's what he said. He's acknowledging he's going to have a hell of a hard time spending his money. Mm-hmm. He's got to go from the mindset of accumulation. And he indicates in here that since 1983, he has been working for a major U.S. oil company. And he's going to get into his pension question in a minute. But since 83, he's been accumulating assets, folks, and saving money and investing. And now all of a sudden, in 2 years, he has to start spending those dollars, watching those dollars drop, not rise. Studies have shown, many studies have shown, people who receive a steady paycheck throughout retirement, whether it's Social Security, pension, or income annuity, feel more comfortable spending money than those who are debiting solely from a portfolio. Mm-hmm. Because when you're debiting from a portfolio, you're sitting there thinking, how long am I going to live? Is the older me going to need this money? Do I really want to go out to eat tonight? What if the 90-year-old me is still around and needs that money? And what if it's not here? And you start convincing yourself, or, geez, the market's down, or, gosh, the Middle East is blowing up, and Russia invaded this, and the U.S. election is crazy, and this is going on, and that's going on. And you can easily convince yourself not to spend money. You can blame it on other things. Well, I didn't spend money because of this, that, and the other thing. You'll use that as an excuse, but emotionally, you just don't want to spend your money. But if you had a steady paycheck, a bottomless cup of coffee is the best analogy, folks. And it's true. If you're at a cafe and you know this coffee is just going to keep getting replaced, who cares if it gets cold? Ah, no big deal. She'll come back and warm it up. If you knew you were getting a steady paycheck forever, it's going to make spending money, especially discretionary, frivolous money, a lot easier to do. And I think he recognizes that. So very keen. I'm reading between the lines, listener, but very keen you picked up on that. That's the emotional risk that our approach attempts to handle as well. Okay. So he continues. I plan to collect my Social Security at 70. I have been working for a major U.S. oil company since 1983 and with them have a defined benefit pension. That pension can give me a lump sum option. Lump sum option, folks, for those who don't know, rather than taking a lifetime stream of income that he cannot outlive, he can say that, how with it, just give me one big check that represents everything you would have given to me over the course of my life expectancy based on current interest rates. That's a lump sum payout. My wife is 8 years younger than I am, so I am weighing whether I should take a pension with a survivor benefit or if I should take the lump sum. I cannot defer the start of my benefits, and my benefit must be either all lifetime pension payments or all lump sum. So my questions for you, how should I approach this decision? Lifetime income or lump sum pension? And how do you recommend your clients incorporate adjustments for inflation on their secure income because my pension does not receive cost of living adjustments and my Social Security by itself will not be enough to cover my minimum dignity floor? Any thoughts, Chris?
Yes. There's always the age old, just straight up doing some kind of comparison, the value of the pension payment option versus the value of the lump sum. And there's a variety of ways that you could look at those. Where I would stand is, don't make this an independent decision. This needs to be, how does this component that I have, this financial resource that I have, how can it best serve me in my broader retirement plan? Which is going to then involve you looking at your situation and when you're retiring, when you're going to need money, size of your minimum dignity floor, all this. Now, unfortunately, with pensions that are an all or nothing choice, I got to take the whole lump sum, or I have to, you know, essentially effectively annuitize the whole thing. I can't do, let's say, in his determinations, he'd really rather have the pension be half of it. He'd like to take half the lump sum and half pension. Well, the pension system in his work isn't giving him that option, but you can simulate that. You could take the lump sum and annuitize half of it, and then you'd have the other half as liquid. So that's always an option. So don't feel like you have to, if you want some income, you don't have to take the 100% option. You could use an alternative to the pension. Now, you certainly wouldn't want to, if the pension is particularly rich in its payouts, this is where you'd want to assess it and make sure that you're not walking away from something that somehow formulaically is particularly attractive, because that could overcome a lot of weaknesses to it not being a great fit. If it's just a ridiculous payout compared to the lump sum, then you may very well opt for that because, yeah, you know, those dollars are going to come in, and even though it might be more than you need for the minimum dignity floor, there's nothing inherently wrong with paying for fun expenses with secure income. You certainly can. We have a lot of clients that have enough Social Security and pension income that it covers a lot of both, and there's always this, you know, a few very rare cases, we call them unicorns, where their secure income covers all expected expenses for their entire lives. They technically don't need a single other dollar for distribution to cover unmet needs and wants and wishes. Everything is wrapped up in there. So it's got to fit into your broader plan, and then some reasonable assessment of the value of the two. And if the, again, the monthly payout or yearly payout option, if that's particularly rich or particularly bad, if it's not very attractive, then they're maybe encouraging you to leave with the lump sum through the formula. So start with what do you need it to do? Then assess, does it meet that need? And if not, then look for maybe alternatives in there. The inflation adjustment might be one of them. Maybe you prefer secure income that actually increases over time through some kind of contractual increase. You can't get that with your pension. You could get that with an income annuity, though. Income annuities offer a variety of increases every year. And if you would like that instead, that might be your answer right there. The pension won't give me the inflation adjustment that I'm looking for, so let me take the lump sum. Now, because if you pursue an inflation adjustment, it's going to start lower and then grow over time than what the pension payout's going to be, the flat pensions. But because they're not going to grow, they usually start higher dollar for dollar, but then there's no growth on it. But again, depending on your circumstances and situation, you might prefer one over the other. So I wouldn't abandon it simply because it doesn't have a cost of living adjustment, though. I don't think that's a deal killer. It just depends on how all your projections look and how it fits into your overall situation.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with all of what you said, and I'll just add my own thoughts. I'm uncertain if he should take mm-hmm. the lump sum or not. Right. You've got to crunch the numbers. I'm leaning towards the lump sum because you indicated the pension, your Social Security alone is not going to cover all your minimum dignity floor. So if there is going to be a shortage, you should start crunching the numbers. You must be good with an Excel spreadsheet. You're listening to this program, or you can hire an advisor to help you if you're not. But start projecting your minimum dignity floor, adjust it for inflation, put your Social Security benefit in that you know you're going to get, and your wife's spousal benefit that she'll get. And you can also do survivorship calculations later as well. But right now I'm talking about the couple you. So get your secure income in there. We generally increase Social Security at what, 2%, Chris?
Currently we're using 2.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep, have been for a while.
So you can increase the Social Security for a cost of living adjustment. I would use somewhere between 2 and 3%, I think, is on the target, maybe not the bullseye, but on the target, not in any given year, but throughout the course of your retirement, that could be a reasonable assessment. Then look at the shortage. So get your minimum dignity floor expenses, project those, that's easy. Project your Social Security, subtract the two, and see what that shortage is. If it is significantly less than what your lifetime pension would be, you might want to consider taking the lump sum pension payout, because you would only have to annuitize some of the dollars to cover that initial shortage. The rest of the dollars, they can be earmarked for future needs to keep pace with inflation. And if you don't need them all, they can be used for other purposes. But if your shortage on your minimum dignity floor and Social Security is so great that the majority of that pension is being eaten by it, now you're going to want to see if the pension is a good deal before you take it, though. So then I would simply go and try to get an immediate annuity quote of what a 70-year-old, because you said, a 65-year-old, what would that income stream generate for someone 65? Now, you can go to most websites. ImmediateAnnuities.com is what most of you probably go to. We're not pushing that site. But I believe it will even allow you to say, hey, today, if I put my lump sum pension payment, you say that's your today contribution, whatever you would be entitled to today. You put that in as the current contribution. Indicate you want a joint and survivor, because you have to make sure this matches your pension estimate, apples to apples. So you said this is a joint and survivor pension. So you're going to indicate that you want to put, let's just say the lump sum is $600,000. You're going to say, I'm going to put $600,000 in. Here is my age, my state of residence. Here is my spouse's age, my spouse's state of residence. Here's our respective genders. And we want a joint and survivor pension payout. And we want the income to begin and match it to where the income in your pension is supposed to begin, and see what that dollar amount is. If it's significantly less than the pension, if the pension is just eating its lunch, I'd be hard-pressed if those numbers, as I said, are really close. Your shortage in minimum dignity floor is so great, much of that pension is going to go to it. It doesn't have to be all of the pension. I would go with the pension in that case if the annuity is no way near what the pension is offering you. But if the annuity is very close or reasonably close, again, it becomes a more nuanced decision and one that you would have to be comfortable with. But whatever money you take from that pension, it should all be earmarked towards your income needs. Don't take the pension out and go blow it on something and then don't have the money to cover your minimum dignity floor. But you need to do some analysis on the pension. Right now, with interest rates relatively high to where they've been over the past 10 years, but exceptionally low compared to where they were in 83 when you just started working for the oil company, interest rates were double digit. But in light of where interest rates are right now, lump sum pension payouts are getting smaller, because the higher the interest rate is, the lower the lump sum payout is. Conversely, the amount of income you get from a SPIA, single premium immediate annuity, is the opposite. It's going up as interest rates went up. So because of those two dichotomies, lump sum payouts are going shorter, smaller, and annuity payments are rising, you might see, Chris, that the annuity might be giving the pension a run for its money.
Mm-hmm. So, and there's a lot more flexibility out in the annuity world. You can dial it in. You don't have to do an all or nothing annuitization. You can get no cost of living adjustment. You can get an inflation adjustment built into it. You have lots of choices out there, probably more choices than you have with your pension. Now, sometimes the pension will have some unique features in it. You didn't give us your whole pension benefit estimate statement, so we can't observe what all the choices are. And sometimes there are some unique options in there, like a joint and survivor, but with a pop-up. Those of you who have that will know what I'm talking about, which you don't really see in the annuity world. There's other survivorship options that sometimes aren't readily available in the annuity side. So, you know, there's pros and cons to each one of it, but I think it really comes down, whenever I look at one and I've got someone who hasn't decided what they're going to do with their pension, we look at the pension after we've established the whole landscape. We look at the whole situation, and then we start to see, gee, what is going to solve this? How could this best be put to use? And if it's a great fit, taking it as the pension, the monthly pension, then that kind of leads you to an answer. If it's doesn't really fit well that way, then looking for alternatives and then doing the calculation, doing the assessment that Jim said, that's kind of what I was mentioning before as well, where you want to make sure that the pension just doesn't have a really attractive payout, because that could kind of trump everything else. That if it's just a mind-boggling monthly payment compared to the lump sum option, that kind of forces your hand to accept it. Otherwise, it'd just be ridiculous to walk away from that benefit. But that's not super common, but it does happen every once in a while.
Okay. Do we have time for another?
Not a big long one like we've been doing. If you had a shorter one, we could fit a shorter one in.
Well, it's a long question. The answer could be, how many minutes do we have?
I'd say 10, maybe.
10 minutes. Yeah, I think we can do the answer in 10 minutes. Okay. So he begins by simply saying that he is a do-it-yourselfer for the past 35 years. I was invested exclusively in the stock market up until 7 years ago. Since then, I have put some money into corporate bonds that was managed by, and I won't mention who, the fees for the bond management was very low. That money basically broke even and maybe even slightly lost value over the past 7 years. So I'm wary of bonds. I'm extremely comfortable with stocks, though. But as I get older, I'm now 60, I realize I need to protect some of my assets. A lot of the reason, listener, I don't want to go too deep. I don't know what particular bond fund you had. I'm familiar with your bond manager. That is a well-known Wall Street brand name, if you will, when it comes to managing bonds. So I don't know the particular fund you had with them, but I do know you're writing this in 2024. So you initially purchased these in around 2007. Or so, when interest rates were low and bonds were not paying much, and interest rates then spiked high over the past 2 years quickly, decimating the bond market, and you just kind of fell victim to bad timing in bonds. The company you reference is a renowned bond fund manager. Company, and they have been very, very successful with bonds, not for 7 years, but for over 50 years. So don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, as they say. I hope that's what they say. So don't throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, oh, I had a bad 7 years with bonds. Bonds stinks. I'm not using bonds. I've been investing in stocks for 60 years and I'm comfortable with them. I'm going back to stocks. There's nothing inherently wrong with bonds. You just have to understand how they work. But also, listener, I'm guessing, based on the manager you're using, you used open-ended bond funds, whether you used them on a mutual fund structure or an exchange-traded fund structure, ETF or mutual fund structure. You had what is called an open-end bond. you didn't benefit from owning a particular bond that you bought at par, and if you just hold it till it matures, you get all your money back, and all the noise of bonds rising and dropping in between the day you bought it and the day it matures at par is immaterial. You're living off of the interest it's paying, and you're going to get your money back when it matures. When you own an open-ended bond fund, you don't get that flexibility, and I think that's also what's freaked you out a little bit. You own an open-ended bond fund that doesn't mature, and you bought it at a period of time when the interest it was paying out was low, and then it got decimated 2 years ago when bonds lost on average 15%, which for a bond is a massive correction. So anyways, I just wanted to share that. Here's the meat and potato of his question. I love your thinking on how to structure your investments and create an annuity. I love your thinking about how to structure your investments and to create basically an annuity that an individual can manage, so all your basic needs and fun spending is covered. It's not quite what we do, listener, and we don't have enough time to delve deep into that. Let me move on to your basic question. I think, though, I'm missing the point. Since it seems that your methodology to guarantee your minimum dignity floor and your fun money is not invested in the stock market, it seems that some of the money should be invested in the market for items that won't be needed for 10 or more years. I know it opens you up to investment risk, but it also provides the possible solution to inflation eating up your plan. Mm-hmm. Can you explain if you use stocks or indexed ETFs as part of your investment methodology? And if so, where might you use it? So, listener, I think what you're getting at is we have said on the show, we believe that money earmarked to the delay period minimum dignity floor needs, that's from retirement up until all your secure income is turned on, because it has an end date. For most people, it's age 70 when Social Security is fully turned on. But because there's an end date, we believe in covering those dollars with just a lump sum, figure out what the need is. And we have shared that those dollars should be principally protected because they're for minimum dignity floor needs.
In the near term.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So just looking at MDF first before I get to fun, we do use stocks sometimes in that holding, but it depends how long the delay period is. You hit the nail on the head when you said 10 years or more maybe should be invested in equities. We look at the length if we're managing assets. You don't have to have us manage your assets, but if we were managing assets for someone, we will look at the length of that delay period, MDF period. For many people, it's only a couple of years. If they retire at 65 and their delay period ends at 70, no, I'm not going to go with stocks. But if they retire at 55 and their delay period ends in 15 years at 70, absolutely. Now, the money that they need closer, we create what we call more of a liquidity timeline. And money that they're going to need early, year 1, 2, 3, 4, we will have very principal protected. Year 5, 6, 7, 8, we might use a multi-year guaranteed annuity, which is also principally protected, but pays significantly higher rates than we can get on quote-unquote safe money. But maybe year 8, 9, 10, all the way through 15, I have no problem investing those dollars. Now, we use buffered funds a lot for this. They're stock investments that are buffered on the downside. We've talked about those in the past. But we talk to the person. And if the person is open with us and saying, you know, I freak out if I see negatives, then yes, we will most likely buffer those assets. But if the person is like you, investing for decades and decades, very comfortable with equities, understands volatility, we would have no problem, even though it's minimum dignity floor money. But if you're 8, 9, 10 plus years out before you need it, I would have no problem taking a investment approach with those dollars. And the same with fun. I don't have to go on and on. Fun is the same thing. We generally will ask people in a perfect year, how much do you see yourself spending on fun? Give us the bucket year type thing. Just go to town. How much could you conceivably see spending on fun in any given year? And whatever that dollar amount is, they tell us, especially during the go-go phase, that becomes our targeted liquidity. Now, we have seen that people who give us that number very rarely spend that much. They're giving us their best case scenario. They often spend less, but we'll make sure that we have at least 1 or 2 years of that dollar amount in cash. Then we start trailing it off. Maybe in year 3, 4, and 5, we'll have 70% of that need, maybe in a MYGA or brokered CD. But again, the same thing, dollars that they're not anticipated to need for year 8, 9, 10, 11, we may be a little more prone to investing, but we very rarely, with fun, go fully unbuffered. And there's a reason. When it's minimum dignity floor expenses, those expenses are fairly, I don't want to say stagnant, but they're fairly steady. They're increasing for inflation, yes, folks. But you pretty much spend the same amount on food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses every year. So I don't mind the way we do it. We're putting in more of a spending ladder when it comes to minimum dignity floor. But when it comes to fun, we don't lock you or our clients into a dollar amount. And just if somebody told me, Jim, the most I can see me spending is $100,000, that's not their budget. I don't care if they call me and want $200,000. I'm going to target $100,000 of liquidity at any given period of time, but I'm going to make sure all remaining dollars that I'm investing, I do want growth. Our targeted rate of return for fun is 3%, and we key that off of the recreational CPI number. So I want to beat 3%, but I'd like to beat the dollars that might be spent on fun 7, 8, 9, 10 years from now, significantly greater than 3% if possible. But I want downside emotional protection on that fun pool. I don't want my clients in their go-go phase to ever say to me, we're not spending on fun. We just looked at our portfolio. Or I'm not going to lock them into this hypothetical $100,000 I'm giving of spending amount that they need and say to them, hey, you told me you only wanted to spend $100,000. I can't get the rest of your money out. It's in the market and the market's down. So fun we're a little more cautious with because we want that liquidity. We want it at any time. And I want that principal protection from an emotional standpoint, but also because fun is so volatile. You might decide, I'm going to buy a new car this year, I'm going to pay for my daughter's wedding, and I'm going to go on an elk hunting trip. Sound more like me on the elk hunting trip. But we're not going to limit you. Oh, nope, you can't. You spent more than $100,000. You told us the most you'd ever spend is $100,000. No. When you get that fun number, that's your budget. So we do put more buffered products when we're investing the more growth part of fun, because I want to protect, and if I can remove the first 20 or 30% drop in the equity market, that's a big, big matzo ball that we can protect and have those dollars available in a worst case scenario if need be. So anyways, we're going to talk a lot more about how we approach our asset positioning and allocation, most likely in July and August. May will take us through our process. June is Annuity Awareness Month. And then July and August, we'll get into a lot of how we do positioning. But I gave you a brief synopsis of how we do things. But in short, listener, you're 100% right. You don't need to put it all in very safe investments. But don't lose sight of one thing. Your targeted rate of return is the inflationary pressure on each reserve and what it's being earmarked for. Fun expenses do not go up a lot. Travel does. And the recreational CPI does not include hotel and travel. Recreational CPI ticks me off. But travel can go up. But for the most part, spending on fun things, or at least what the government considers recreational things, doesn't go up at the same pace as minimum dignity floor. So if your targeted rate of return is 3, or if you travel, I would go as high as 3.8, or 4. If that's your targeted rate of return, and you can buy right now a 5-year multi-year guaranteed annuity paying 5.6, do you need to take the investment risk? Maybe for you, listener, yes, because you love investing. But everybody else, you might be perfectly happy saying, wait a minute. If I'm trying to get 4 and I can guarantee myself 5.6, I'd be fine with that. So it's really going to come down to where you are from an emotional and risk tolerance standpoint as well. Okay, Chris.
As in add more to it or wrap it up.
Wrap it up.
We're about to the wrap up phase. So, yeah, so if we've been giving the impression that we don't use equities for funding retirement, that was not the impression we're trying to make. There's certainly needs, goals in retirement, perfectly normal to be using equities as part of the financial holdings that will ultimately satisfy those future goals. We certainly didn't mean to say that we're giving up equities, if that was the
impression. He's not the first person, Chris, even people we work with, clients of ours whose assets we manage, because we used to word it, and I used to say it needs to be principally protected. And when you hear those words, what do you think, Chris, when you hear principal protection?
I think money in the bank or
some low return.
Kind of insurance, yeah, low return product. Yeah,
boring, low return. Now I try to say a degree of principal protection. Because since the advent of Buffett exchange traded funds that can achieve what I had to use an annuity for in the past, a fixed indexed annuity, those are annuities that I had to use in the past. I haven't put someone in a fixed indexed annuity in a long time, years and years. Because I like the buffered ETFs. I can get the benefits of a fixed indexed annuity without all the downside of fixed indexed annuities. And these buffered products give a degree of principal protection. Yes, you give up some of the upside. I hate when people, but you're going to give up the upside. If your targeted rate of return for fun is 3 or 4% if you're a heavier traveler, who cares if your quote-unquote cap rate is 11, 12, 13, 14, 15%? That's 2, 3, 4 times your targeted rate. Don't get greedy. It's a return of your money in retirement, not a return on your money that matters. But we're not blind to growth investments. We're locked into our clients' risk tolerance and comfort, yes. But dollars that we feel comfortable won't be needed for 8 or more years, we're all on board with trying to get growth. We just put a degree of principal protection on them. for an emotional and sequence of return risk standpoint when it comes to fund. Because don't lose sight of that, listener. You might be comfortable with equities, but you're also in your go-go phase. And you might think, I'm never going to spend more than $50,000 a year on fund. I'm going to keep $50,000 in the bank every year. And you might have 1 year where you're going to want to go to town and spend three times that. And it might be a year when your equities are down, and now you're running into sequence of return risk. That, to me, is the biggest trick of managing fund. We don't limit you to a safe withdrawal rate on fund. I want you to spend it whenever you want. You got your fund number. It's yours. Go spend it. So you have to have a degree of principal protection, but you also need liquidity. And the ETFs are extremely liquid. You can buy them on Monday, sell them on Tuesday. So anyways, that's kind of what we do. You do whatever works for you. But to this George and all of you VGs out there, we're perfectly fine with some equity exposure, absolutely, on MDF and fund.
Yep. Okay, so if you want to send in your own questions for future shows, just send an email directly to Jim. Jim@jimhelps.com is the email, jim@jimhelps.com. And in the subject line, make sure that you indicate that it's a question for the podcast. If it's a question regarding our current series where we're walking everybody through our philosophy and approach, maybe include that in the subject line so it's clear it's not just a random question, but rather a timely question regarding our current series. And we really appreciate everybody listening and sending in those questions because it makes the show work. So thanks a lot, Jim, and everyone else. We'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jimhelps.com or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.